Hello, everyone. I'm Arun Roth, filling in for Tanzina, and this is The Takeaway. In June of last year, Immigration and Customs Enforcement's New York field office made an announcement. It would no longer take detained migrants to court hearings in person. Instead, it would hold hearings exclusively through video teleconferences. On Tuesday, the Brooklyn Defender Services and other legal organizations filed a class action lawsuit against ICE, challenging this move. Joining me in our studios is Andrea Sions, an attorney with the New York Immigrant Family Unity Project at Brooklyn Defender Services. They provide free lawyers to detained low-income immigrants. Thanks for being with us, Andrea.
Thank you for having me.
So can you tell us why you filed this lawsuit? What's wrong with hearings by teleconference?
So what's happening now is that instead of in years prior where our clients were sitting next to us at these hearings that determine whether or not they're going to be free, going to be back with their families, or going to be deported to a country where they possibly face persecution or harm, they are being beamed in by televideo. And it's simply not a fair hearing is the bottom line. They're not being given the opportunity to fully participate in their hearings, to communicate with their counsel, to see the evidence against them. And we think it's fundamentally wrong and unfair for the most important person in the hearing to be the only one who's not in the room.
For people who don't know how it works, can you explain how it's used and how much now?
What's happening right now at VEREC is that every single hearing is being done by video. So it's not just for a routine scheduling conference, you know, come back next month, here's a filing deadline. People are appearing by video for their bond hearings where they're being asked to testify for their own freedom, for hearings where we're determining whether they're mentally competent enough to even understand what the hearing is about, and most importantly, for hearings that are about their entire defense to removal, including whether they can stay permanently with their families or whether they have a case for asylum. So every single kind of hearing is being done on video.
And what's the justification for why they are using video teleconferencing?
Well, the agency has told us a couple of different things. They've told us that they had to do so for security purposes. There's been a protest at VEREC in the past, and that has not stopped the production of people safely to court. And they've also basically told us that it's efficient. And we think that due process is more important than efficiency, and that, in fact, as we explained in the lawsuit, we've had enormous inefficiencies from this policy because the technology has been so problematic that we've had to adjourn hearing after hearing.
Can you give us any examples to tell us how you've seen this practice play out with your clients?
Sure. I think there's a couple different categories of how this has hurt our clients. The first is that they are in detention for a really long time when we can't hold their hearing properly. The government has maintained that this is efficient. Actually, the opposite has happened where we've had days where the hearing couldn't even start because we couldn't connect by video. We couldn't get the interpreter on the line. Or something happened during the hearing where we needed to ask our client, what do you think? Look at this evidence. What we need to make a decision in this moment. But we can't confidentially speak to our client in that moment. So we have to adjourn the entire hearing and then drive out to jail the next day and talk to them and come back and do it. So we've had clients who had to sit in detention for another 2 or 3 months because of what happened in the hearing. That's one category. And then when we go and see them, we've had dozens of clients tell us, I don't know what happened. Can you explain it to me? I couldn't hear. I didn't understand what the judge said. And the other category is just that we think that the judges aren't able to assess our clients' credibility or what's really going on with them over a screen. And the complaint talks about some of those clients in the lawsuit, including, you know, we have a client who had to talk about his sexual orientation over a video in a situation where he didn't feel like it was confidential. And you can imagine how that affects your ability to tell your story. And another client who had serious cognitive limitations and sobbed uncontrollably during his hearing, and we couldn't finish the hearing in time, and it got adjourned. And in the end, the judge denied both of those cases, and we feel like they did not get a fair hearing over video.
Andrea Sions is an attorney with the Brooklyn Defender Services. Andrea, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now let's take a broader look at how immigration courts are relying on video teleconferencing across the country. WNYC's Beth Fertig is here with us. She's been covering this in New York and has also looked into how it's used nationally. Thanks for being here, Beth.
Hi, thank you.
So tell us about a bit more detail about what this actually looks like. Is there somebody on a screen? What is the setup for these court proceedings?
It's like Skype or FaceTime. When you go in the court, you see the immigrant in detention in their orange jumpsuit on a video monitor. And you can see what they're seeing in that little box on the top. They are seeing the judge, they're seeing their lawyer, they're seeing the translator if they need one, and they have a very limited view of the rest of the courtroom. So if there's friends and family who have come to show their support, it looks like they can only see maybe the first row sometimes, or sometimes not even that. It depends how the camera is pointed that day. And there was one time when I was there, there was a man from West Africa on a bond hearing, and he needed a Twi interpreter. And he looked so confused. And at the end of the hearing, when he was actually given bond, you know, when the judge said, yes, I'll let you out on $15,000 bond, it looked like he didn't even know what was happening. Mm-hmm. And then his lawyer called him after and told him, and he was pleasantly surprised.
Now, Beth, give us some insight into the use of this. When did immigration courts begin using this technology?
Well, I can tell you that in the immigration courts, which are their own thing, they're run by the Department of Justice, Congress authorized the use of video for these courts in 1996, and it's really been growing over time. It's mostly used in detention centers. That's how it started, because detention centers could be in very remote locations, and they would need to get judges to hear them, and so the video enabled that. And still to this day, it's used mostly in detention courts.
Do we know how widespread the use is?
It's very widely used right now, Arun. I did a Freedom of Information request to find out how often. And in fiscal year 2018, which ended in October, 126,000 hearings were done by video in immigration courts nationally. That was a 14% increase over the previous year. And there were more hearings, but the rate of increase for video was double the rate of hearings that were being held, the increase in that. So it's definitely been rising. And when I asked how many of these resulted in adjournments because of malfunctions, the Executive Office for Immigration Review, which runs the courts in the Department of Justice, they said about 800 nationally. So they consider it to be a very small number in which things go wrong and it results in adjournments.
Does this actually affect outcomes for immigrant cases? Do we know how this affects court proceedings?
There's only been one really conclusive study, I should say. There's a professor at UCLA Law School named Ingrid Egli, and she did a study that was published in 2015 in which she looked at people who were detained, because that's mostly where the video is used for people detained in detention centers who have to go to court. And it was really interesting because she found that comparing the people who had their hearings by video versus the ones in person, those by video were much more likely to be deported. But here's the other weird thing. She found that if they applied for asylum, there was the same rate of being granted asylum in person versus in video. So when I asked her why, she said it's because something about the video led to suppressed engagement, is how she put it. Hmm. That because the immigrant is sitting there hearing all the information by video, unless they're really motivated already and they're going to apply for asylum, they don't know what's available to them. The translation could be kind of awkward, the connection could be bad, and they're not really getting the same in-person treatment that they would normally get, and they don't know enough about their rights, and they're not likely to get lawyers either. And so that results in them losing more often when it's done by video.
Wow. Beth Fertig is a senior reporter here at WNYC. Beth, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.